This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Assalamu alaikum, YouTube. How y'all doing? I am back with good friend of the show, Sheikh Ismail Kamdar. And he is going to talk to us today about something that is dear and close to his heart, something that he is a professional and expert in, the nature of the modern education system and developing alternatives for the new world that we live in, because Muslims in the year 2024 are faced with many challenges. We have many issues in the modern schooling system, especially if you live outside of the Muslim world. But even if you live inside the Muslim world, things aren't perfectly rosy either. So, with no further ado, Sheikh Ismail Kamdar, if you'd like to tell anything about your background relating to this field of education and why it's so important to you, please go ahead.
Assalamu alaikum. Alhamdulillah. Thanks for having me back on the show. So, this is a passion project of mine, something I've been working on for life and something that I only expected to produce results 10 or 20 years down the line, right? It's a lifelong project for me. And it started when my kids were born. When my kids were born, I was hesitant about putting them in school, right? Because my experience with school was that school was a complete waste of time. Right. This was my experience that so I was in and out of school in a sense that I was in school till grade 8. Then I dropped out to do Islamic studies. Then I skipped grade 9. I skipped a couple grades. I graduated through homeschooling. And then I went to university. And along the way, I realized, hold on, you can skip one or two entire grades and you don't miss out on any actual information and knowledge. Right, I skipped both grade 9 and grade 11. There's literally nothing in grade 9 or 11 that's relevant or important for life, right? It's completely a complete waste of time. So I skipped both those grades and I realized that this system doesn't make sense. And when I first started working, my first job was as a school teacher. And I spent my first 2 years working in Islamic schools. And when I first started, I went in with the mindset that Islamic schools are the way forward. But after 2 years of working in Islamic schools, I came to the conclusion that, hold on, most Islamic schools are not really Islamic. They basically took the same system. They put on a label, so they gave it an Arabic name, made hijab the uniform, and made Islamic studies a subject, right? But that too, a subject that if you fail it, it's no big deal. Right, so it's like a very trivial subject. It's not even an important subject. So the Islamic school system to me was not a proper solution. So as my kids were getting of school age, I began to worry, like, what am I going to do with them? I don't want to put them in the system. The system's messed up. In the Islamic schools that I had seen in my community, zina was rampant. Drugs was rampant. All of these bad ideologies were rampant. These were the Islamic schools. If you went to the non-Muslim schools, the non-Muslim schools in my community, 13 and 14 year olds are getting pregnant, right? It's like, So like, why would you want to take a child and throw them into that environment? It made no sense to me at all. And what boggled my mind even more is that most people don't think about this. Most people are like, oh, the system's a system. You have to go with it. But that's how most people are wired, right? That they imagine, I think in their minds, school has always been around and that's just the way of the world and you have to do it. And I realized that you don't, because I come from a family where some of my relatives dropped out of school and opened businesses and did very well in life, right? Others went to university and did very well in life. Everyone took different paths. And I realized there's not just one path to success. Every individual is unique. Everyone's path is unique. Everyone's skills are unique. And I found my own path to success, which was not directly related to learning. So as a solution, I homeschool my kids. Been homeschooling for over a decade now, since 2012. And along the way, I started teaching other parents how to homeschool. I still do that. In fact, I have a homeschooling class straight after this podcast with one of the online institutes where I teach parents how to homeschool. But to be completely honest with you, I see homeschooling as a band-aid solution. A band-aid solution meaning we have this problem, we can't fix it yet, This is the best alternative we have for now, right? So homeschooling is a band-aid solution. Furthermore, I realized from teaching other parents how to homeschool that most people can't do it in the current environment, in the current the current situation that the governments have built for us. Most people are incapable of homeschooling, right? Because historically, parents taught their own children. Homeschooling was the norm for bulk of human history, especially the moms taught their children. But if you create an economy where mom and dad both have to work full time and they're both too tired when they come home from work to spend quality time for their children, you can forget about them having any time to actually educate their children. So I realized homeschooling doesn't work for everyone. And so this led to me developing a long-term passion project, which is building new systems of learning to replace the modern education system. That's my current area of research. Can we develop new systems of learning that meet the requirements of the 21st century, that are truly Islamic, and that can make the school system completely obsolete, that we don't even need it anymore? And that's why I said this is a 10 or 20 year project. It's not something that I can present solutions to yet. I'm still very early in my research, but I've dedicated my life to this. This to me is something that I really want to do. I really want to help people find a solution to this problem. And I believe deep down inside, I am capable of helping with this, inshallah.
Inshallah, I think so, Sheikh. For starters, I want to go back for a second so we can clarify something, because you know, there's so many terms that get thrown around when we're talking about education systems. And a lot of people don't really understand the history of how the quote unquote modern education system came about. Now, this ties in very strongly with the previous interview we did where you talked about traditional families and getting married earlier. Can you tell us what is the modern education system and how was it developed?
Sure. So I mentioned a bit earlier that most people never think about this, and they just assume that this is the way the world always was. So people will be very shocked to learn that this new, that this education system that we have today has only been around for less than 200 years. And it's only been forced upon people for the past 100 years, right? Upon globally.
Yes.
It only became an international institute about 100 years ago around World War I. So when we say the modern education system, we mean a system where, number one, government controls education, right? Historically, governments did not control educations. It would be parents, mentors, private teachers, madrasas, churches, right? It was a very organic thing that came out from the community to meet the needs of the community. That's how education was for the bulk of human history. About 200 years ago in Germany, right? In Germany, to create patriotic citizens that would accept whatever the government say, the government invented the current school system, right? To create patriotic citizens. That was the goal. And other European countries, seeing the success of this, they began to model the system. So what is the system? The system is, as soon as you're able to think for yourself, they stop you from thinking for yourself. As soon as you are 5, 6, 7 years old, they throw you into this building that's basically like a prison. There's very strict rules. There's these bells, there's these tiny breaks. You're not allowed to talk. You know, there's no scope for different opinions. There's always a right answer and a wrong answer. You're forced to accept whatever the teacher says, tells you is right. And you're just stuck in there for your entire childhood and your young adulthood. Your entire childhood and young adulthood, you are stuck in the system for 13 years. And then on top of that, there's the university system. So if someone's going to school and university, they are spending, especially if they go all the way to PhD, they are spending 20 years of their life, the prime of their life, the best years of their life, in a system designed to make you a good citizen, to make you not question your government. But it gets worse, because 100 years ago, when this system proved to be effective, in America, and capitalism was starting to really go full swing. The main capitalists in America, the billionaires, the Rockefellers, the Carnegies, you know, these figures, they realized we could use the system to produce factory workers and office workers. So they funded and rolled out an international acceptance of the system. this international model that we have today, that every country in the world has the same school system and the same university system, very few differences. It started in Germany, and then it got accelerated in the United States of America. The purpose of it became to produce factory workers and office workers, people who don't think, people who will follow, people who will do what you tell them to do. This was the purpose of it, right? And so this system became the system. And what's interesting in America is it only stayed compulsory in America for about 30 years until the homeschooling movement started and they rebelled against it. Because within 30 years, people realized the system doesn't make sense. It's not working. It's not what we want for our children. So around the 1930s to 1940s, there was a massive homeschooling movement in the United States of America, where parents began to push back and say, hold on, this system doesn't work for us. We demand the right to teach our own children.
Yes. Right? Yes.
So like if you look at South Africa, for example, in South Africa, the right to homeschool was only given in 1996 or 1998. Right? Mm. Before that, schooling was compulsory. You had to go through the system. There was no choice about it. Right? And they took the same system and they forced it upon the Muslim world. And in the Muslim world, it was more damaging. It was more damaging in the Muslim world because it replaced systems that were already there and were already effective and already doing a way better job, right? So to give you two examples of how it negatively impacted the Muslim world. Before the modern school system, in the Muslim world, we had a concept of awqaf, of endowments, waqafs, right? And these endowments, many of them were endowments to fund free education. So there were many free schools, free universities. If someone wanted to become a scholar, a sheikh, an alim, they could do so for free. And these endowments would provide them with their monthly salaries so that they could live a comfortable life while pursuing research and academia. There was a system that worked to make sure that education was free, and it was not controlled by the government. It was controlled by the ulama. It was controlled by the sheikhs, the scholars of the community. The government had no control over the system, right? About 150 years ago, the British, when they started colonizing the Muslim world, they couldn't directly colonize the Ottoman Empire, so they began to influence the Ottoman Empire, right? They did colonization via influence. And one of the things they did to influence the Ottoman Empire, and Dr. Wael Hallaq speaks about this in his book, Restating Orientalism, he says one of the things they did is they got rid of the waqf system, the endowment system. They basically told the Ottomans that, listen, these things that you are using, that your people have as free services, you could be making money off that. These could be for-profit services. You have free healthcare, free education, free water. All this stuff are free. It doesn't make any sense from a capitalist perspective. And so first they got the government to take over the endowments, and then a few decades later, they got them to turn them into for-profit industries. So suddenly education has a cost, healthcare has a cost, water has a cost. In the Islamic world, these things were free, right? But the British influence made these things costly. So when these things became costly, that affected the quality of education, the quality of teachers, and also, it gave the British the control over what Muslims were teaching and what was being taught in the Muslim world, right? Because they were now controlling these systems. To add to that, they brought in a mindset that is completely alien to Islam, but most Muslims have adapted today. And that is the mindset of separating between religious knowledge and secular knowledge, right? And we see that today even in the Islamic schools. Even the Islamic schools today have a separation between secular subjects and Islamic subjects. Historically, Muslims never made the separation. Muslims pursue beneficial knowledge. The only distinction we make is between what is beneficial and what is not beneficial. If someone feels that certain knowledge is not beneficial, they will not pursue it, right? But any beneficial knowledge is the lost property of the believer. So if you had to go to a madrasa 400 or 500 years ago, you would study Quran, you would study fiqh, but you would also study algebra, you would also study science, you would also study philosophy, poetry, because anything that would benefit you would be taught in the madrasa. It wasn't seen as separate, from the religion, but seen simply as beneficial knowledge. So when this distinction came in between the secular and the religious, the Muslim community got divided and the Muslim education system got divided. So now we have the secular Muslim and we have the religious Muslim. We have the secular Muslim, this especially was the case between World War One and the 1960s. Between World War One and the 1960s, most of the Muslims who graduated from university or who went through the secular system were not religious, right? They were not religious. And most of the religious Muslims did not have university qualification. It's only in the past 50 years that we began to find some way to bridge the gap, where now we have religious Muslims who have graduated through the secular system. But we haven't completely bridged the gap because we still see them as separate. We still see these as, we still see this as secular knowledge and this as religious knowledge. And as a result, we don't really have the quality of scholars that we had in the past. When you look at the scholars of the early generations, many of them were polymaths, right? A scholar would be a master of the Quran, the Hadith, fiqh, history, mathematics, science, philosophy, medicine. Like one person would master all those fields. Right? And there are hundreds of examples of people like that in our history. It's very rare to find people like that today because of the secularization of knowledge and the division of Islamic and knowledge from other subjects. People tend to go one way or the other. And so this also negatively impacted the Muslim world.
If you don't mind, I'd like to jump in. It seems to me that compared to traditional Islamic systems, that the Western system is very much based on hyper-compartmentalization, to use an absurdly long word. In other words, when I talk to people, I was at one point when I got back from Iraq, I was a political science major, and I was doing really good at political science. And I really wanted to go off and get like a master's and a PhD. And what I started to see, one of the things that turned me off from that path, because I thought I wanted to be a political analyst. One of the things that turned me off from that path was that I couldn't help but notice that some people become hyper-obsessed in their careers over the most minute, mundane things. And it's this, I sat around and talked to these professors. They have this culture of like, how shall we say, take one thing that you're super hyper-focused, interested in, and only that's your life from now on, from now until you get tenured. And I was like,
it's interesting because I tweeted something similar yesterday, right? I tweeted something similar yesterday. A lot of our Islamic studies graduates who graduated from Western universities instead of Islamic universities, they don't actually have the broad baseline knowledge of Islam that you expect from an Islamic studies graduate.
Right.
Like, if you study Islamic studies in the East, you will learn the foundations of Quran, Hadith, Arabic, Tafsir, Fiqh, all these different sciences, and then you might specialize in one or two. Like how I specialized in Fiqh, Tafsir, and history, but I still know all the other subjects enough to teach it, right? But what I found from those who graduated in the West is they would go all the way to PhD. They would get a PhD and call themselves a professor in Islamic studies, and people would treat them as an expert and as someone who can lead the Salah. But when you talk to them, their PhD was like super niche. It's like certain scholars' book on a specific topic in a specific year related to a specific field. And that's all they know about. They don't know about anything else. They have like no knowledge of Arabic, no knowledge of Quran, no knowledge of Hadith, but people assume they're experts in Islamic studies. Again, it's exactly what you are saying, right? That they hyper-focused on the most random and mundane aspects. You know, like there's so many books produced from Western universities on Islamic studies that I tried reading. They were like 400, 500 page books with absolutely no benefit in them at all. Like they would just take the most obscure of things and just write and write just to say they produced something, because that's what the goal of Western academia, to produce. The goal of Islamic knowledge is to benefit the ummah, right? And to bring people closer to God. The purpose of knowledge in the West is just to produce. It's just to produce something new. So you have to always produce something new, no matter how useless it is.
Yeah, that was something that my professors, when I was studying political science, would tell me. They said, Harry, if you want to get into this field, if you're really interested, young man, you have to publish or die. If you do not publish,
I had the same experience. Relevancy.
Yeah, and I just sort of drove me insane, the idea of continuing down this path for 10, 20 years. And then what I found years later when I thought about going back to try and finish my bachelor's and then trying to get into a master's and a PhD, because I have a real interest in politics and international relations. What I found is from the people who had gotten those degrees, they pulled me aside and they said, I mean, it's valuable for finding a job in the government, but what they also said is everything that they learned in their when they finished the 2 years after I dropped out, you know, the extra 2 years that they had or whatever, they said, I could have learned from a Google search or learned on my own, come up to my own conclusions.
Wow. Yeah, you know, interesting. You and I had the same experience, even though we're studying different subjects. So when I completed my bachelor's degree, my teachers tried to convince me to do a master's degree. Right till today, they still try to convince me to do a master's degree, even though this was like a decade ago. But what I found is, when I tried to see like what's the benefits of a master's degree, the only benefit I could find from it is to boast that I have a master's degree. That's like the only benefit. Nothing that they were teaching was a benefit to me. Most of it was stuff I could study on my own. I already have a job that I enjoy. I already have a business that's thriving. What exactly would you get out of this besides being able to boast and tell someone I have a master's and you don't? Right. So I decided it's not worth my time to pursue a master's degree.
No, and it seems to me that there's a hyper-emphasis on memorization of information rather than how to analyze and use the information.
Yes,
and
that's a big one.
Yeah. That's something that comes out of the German factory model. And of course, I'm assuming, and you might know, you probably know this more than I do, I'm assuming that classical Western education, when it was provided by the church, was probably much closer to classical Islamic education.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like if you look at the Ottoman Empire, they had the millet system, right? Millet means religion. And basically, the way a Sharia land works is that every community follows their own book, right? So in the Ottoman Empire, if you had to go to a Christian village or a Christian town, the whole village and town is run by the Bible. From the education system to the criminal law, all of it's run by the church. And that's part of living under Sharia. People don't realize that. Christians and Jews have more freedom under Sharia because you controlled your education system. You could apply biblical law to your community. You could actually live a fully Christian life, right, in those pockets. And so what you would find in the Ottoman Empire was that governments did not control knowledge. They did not control information. It was the community that did. It would be the sheikhs in the Muslim lands. It would be the priests in the Christian lands. It would be the rabbis in the Jewish lands. And the government would stay out of it completely. And so, yes, knowledge. And also, another important point was that the systems of knowledge that developed before that originated in the Muslim world. And Christians and others adapted it from the Muslims. What I mean by this is that during the Abbasid era, so we're going back about 1,000 years ago, the Muslims developed things like research centers, libraries, madrasas, and some kind of university. Not the same like today, but they had a type of university, right? A place where you could study advanced knowledge and graduate in that field, right? And non-Muslims, Christians and Jews, would learn Arabic so that they could go to these institutes and study with the Muslim professors. And then they would take that same system back to their lands and try and replicate it in their lands. So the Muslim world actually had a very strong influence on the types of systems of knowledge that began to become common in the Christian world after that point in time, especially once the Muslims were in Spain. Muslims ruled over Spain for 700 years. During that time, Islamic Spain was the center of knowledge in Europe, and the rest of Europe was influenced by Muslim Spain. They would send their best minds to study under the Muslims. And they learned philosophy from the Muslims and took it back to the rest of Europe. They learned morality from the Muslims and took it back to the rest of Europe. They learned systems of learning from the Muslims and took it back to the rest of Europe. So a lot of what was going on in the Christian world was ideas that they had emulated from the Muslim world. And so it was very similar systems in place, right? And it was a very effective system because you would find that at that point in time, communities were producing people of genuine knowledge. Like even the Jews, it was in that system that Maimonides emerged, the most famous Jewish philosopher. Yeah, he was a product of the Muslim education system. He studied in the Muslim education system. He was the doctor of Salahuddin Ayyubi. He thrived in that system, right? So that system allowed the production of geniuses for anyone to look there. But just as we have the Muslims of today no longer have that system, the same thing happened with the West. And by the way, there was pushback in the West as well. The idea of church schools, they heavily opposed the idea of government education. It was a long, there's a long history of a clash between church schools and government schools, because they did not want to give their power to the governments. They knew that it was not, that it was not a good idea for governments to take over this thing.
Yes. Yeah. I'd be, if I may be so brazen, I don't think it's an accident that the decline in monarchical systems and the rise of central banking, the rise of government schools, and the tragedies of World War One and World War Two are all interconnected. In other words,
they are most definitely interconnected. And I can tell you a few ways they're interconnected, right? Number one, the purpose of the school system was to create patriotic citizens, people who are willing to die for their country, right? Those are the people who fought in World War One and World War Two, people willing to do anything for their country. People's commitment was no longer towards God and towards family and towards tribes, but towards a sense of patriotism. This allowed them to form armies that were willing to just die for them. On top of that, the modern financial system basically allowed them to have infinite resources for producing weapons. You see, wars of the past never reached the level of devastation of World War One and World War Two, because wars were always limited by the budget of the government.
Yes. Right?
Governments had budgets. But once you start printing your own money, guess what? Guess what's happening now? Now $14 billion going to Israel. Where is it coming from? They're just printing it. Right? If you can just print your own money, you now have an infinite budget for war. And now that's why we have this level of destruction in the past 100 years that never existed before. So it's all linked. It's all a product of the colonial liberal system that it started about 400 years ago. And people think the colonial era is over, but we are still living in its shadow. We are still living in the systems that they produced, whether it's the economic system, the school system, or even the state system itself. This idea of having countries and being loyal to your country, and the country having power and control over everything from the type of school your child goes to being able to seize your passport, to seize your bank account. This is all very new. This is all part of that project. We're still stuck in that project, right? The effects of colonization are still everywhere in every part of the world.
Yeah, I can see some of that for sure. Yeah, I see here in Indonesia, people are still shaking off the shackles of the colonist mindset. And I see it even in subtle things. I'm going to make this point, and then I want to go back in history a little bit, if you don't mind. But I want to make this point. I see this in Indonesia all the time, that Indonesians, even though they bravely fought for their independence, what I see with Indonesians always coming up to me and talking to me, hey, bule, meaning foreigner, white Western foreigner, I have to sometimes pull my Indonesian friends aside and be like, y'all don't have to be this nice to me. Meaning, I don't want people to be mean to me, but there is this act of some people almost, girls in Indonesia will always buy whitening cream. And I always noticed that, I was talking to my wife last night, who's Indonesian. She said that a lot of Indonesian guys fantasize about marrying a beautiful white European woman, as opposed to Indians. A local brown. Yeah. Same with Indians. And it's just like, you know, they fought for their independence. They won. They're very proud of their independence, as they should be. Mm-hmm. They're very proud of their country and their history and their heritage as Indonesians, as they should be. But yet there's this like this thing in the background. And then I think of myself, you know, 5 years in the army, you know, military police, my friends and I, you know, all my buddies, all my guys from the old unit, we always joke about how brainwashed we are. Like the whole process of how people are trained in modern warfare, modern techniques that really kind of go back to the Napoleonic era. Well, some of them, maybe you could even say Spartans, but the way we're trained in basic training and advanced training in the military now is essentially Pavlovian. You know, all the weird things that you see happening in movies like Full Metal Jacket, all those mental games, that's Pavlovian, to generate certain instinctual responses to produce the kinds of people that will go out and die for the causes. And alhamdulillah, I see in Gen Z in particular, I mean, I see them on TikTok. They're just like, I'm not signing up for war. I'm not going to go to college. I don't want to play this stupid corporate game anymore. I'd rather just stay at home and like do my own thing. And people are losing their minds. Like, you see the mainstream corporate media just losing it. Like, oh, Gen Z, they're just so lazy and they're incompetent. And everybody hates on Gen Z right now. But you know what? I think they're actually kind of, I think they're waking up to the control system. Maybe they.
I have a theory behind that. My theory is that the pandemic and the lockdown woke everybody up. That's when people realize these governments have too much control. They have too much power. Right. And that was the breaking point for many people, because a lot of things I used to speak about since 2010, and people used to think I'm crazy. People used to think I'm a conspiracy theorist. People used to think I'm extreme or backwards. Those same points, they're making it themselves now after the lockdown. Right. They're making the same points themselves after the lockdown. They're beginning to see that, hold on, this is right. Right. Because people bought into this idea that they have freedom. They bought into this idea of progress. They bought into this idea that society is always moving forward, that this democracy and these states, that this is the best system for the world. And then the lockdown happens, and these governments can take anything from you and do anything to you and force you to do anything they want. And people realize, hold on, there's not much freedom here. No, we don't really have a say in anything. And this really broke people's spirits. It really broke people's faith in the governments. I'll tell you something else that's breaking people's faith in the governments and making them realize that there isn't really freedom. Last year, regardless of what people think of him, I'm not making a value judgment on him specifically, but last year when Andrew Tate was arrested, right, the governments seized all his assets, all his valuables, threw him in prison for 6 months before trials even began. Now, I'm not talking about him specifically. I'm not saying whether he's right or wrong. I'm simply saying the system that we live in is such that if they don't like you, they can seize all your assets and throw you in jail without a trial. That's what we learned from that, right? That's a very scary reality about these countries that are supposed to have freedom. And people seeing that, even people who don't agree with him, but seeing that, realize that, hold on, this freedom is an illusion. We don't really have freedom in the system.
No, we don't. Andrew Tate was certainly a very powerful man, and he still is. In fact, alhamdulillah, he might even be more powerful than he ever was before. Sort of like Obi-Wan Kenobi after Star Wars when Darth Vader strikes him down. But if they can do it to Andrew Tate, they can do it to anybody. I mean, right now, I'm here in Jakarta, Indonesia, on a 100% disability check from the Department of Veterans Affairs. If I say the wrong thing, theoretically, now in America, we do have more legal protections. It would be really unpalatable. It would not be a very good look for the government to shut down the bank account of some crazy guy who lives as an expat abroad.
But they have done it.
They have done it. They could. At any time, they could just be like, you know, we don't like this hairy elf guy. He's talking too much. Yeah, they sure could. I want to circle back to something in history, because this is an issue that comes back. This is an issue of contention right now. Clearly, when I look at the history of America in particular, with our United States Constitution and our Bill of Rights and what the Founding Fathers and the writings of the Founding Fathers, and also some of the classic things from Europe that you were talking about earlier with classical education before it got influenced by this modern Germanic system. Daniel Hakikachu has spoken extensively about how he just really doesn't like liberalism. And I understand where Daniel Hakikachu is coming from. And of course, he went to Harvard. He's a very smart, educated guy. And he's seen the belly of the beast. Is there a way we can qualify that? Because some of what is labeled as liberalism seems influenced by classical Islam, And some of what is liberalism is like devolved into what we see now with the modern banking system offshooting into fascism and communism and the complete destruction of the traditional family and Christianity and any sort of religious influence whatsoever. So when we're talking about liberalism, how do we distinguish between what is influenced by Islam and what is influenced by something else?
You could do that with anything, but I have a very simple principle that any man-made philosophy will have flaws. So we don't follow that philosophy, we follow Islam, right?
Okay.
So we don't need liberalism, we just need Islam. Really, if Islam, if you really take time to study the works that Islam teaches on politics, on education, on social reform, on family, on growing a community, you will realize we don't need anything that liberalism has to offer. Whatever right. we need, you will find it within Islam. So the idea here is not that every single thing that liberals teach is wrong. That's not what we're saying. What we're saying is that the philosophy itself is flawed. So we don't need that philosophy. We follow Islam instead. And whatever good is in liberalism, you will find it in Islam as well, amplified.
Right.
But without all the baggage, without all the negative stuff. So we don't need anything to do with that philosophy.
Okay. So liberalism, the Enlightenment, things of this nature, these have some echoes of Islam because Islam was...
They do. Like, for example, the idea of innocent until proven guilty, that originated in Islam, right? So that's one example. That's probably the clearest example, right? The current concept of justice... a lot of it is taken from the Sharia. The Sharia is built on justice, and a lot of the elements of justice that are applied in the West today were borrowed from the Muslim world.
Okay, good. Well, I appreciate you answering that. So, I know it's a little bit off topic here, but when I talk to older people back in the States who are super hardcore constitutionalists still, I often say that a lot of the good things in the U.S. Constitution can also be found in Islam, and that this idea that creeping Sharia is just going to come in and we're all going to be slaves. Would you say that most of these modern Islamic governments, if you're comfortable saying this, if not, I understand, we can edit this out later. Saudi Arabia, for example, would you say that Saudi Arabia is a good example of classical Islamic law and practice?
There is no good example of classical Islamic law in practice for one very simple reason. Today, we have countries and states where the government controls everything, and that is not Sharia. That is not Sharia. In Sharia, the government handles protecting the borders and expanding the borders. They handle our relationships with other countries, and they facilitate the application of Sharia, right? The actual day-to-day dealings of Sharia for the average Muslims, the way the average Muslim live their lives, if they need advice, if they need to go to court, that was handled by the ulama. That was handled by the people of knowledge. The government stayed out of it. They stayed out of it. In fact, you could take the government to court. You could take the king to court in Sharia land, right? Because the law was from God, and the law was above the ruler. The ruler's role was to ensure it, right? What we have today, same with the school system, same with the banking system, it's the same with the state system, that we have the Western model of a state and people trying to fit Sharia into that, and it's not working. We have state-imposed Sharia, which does not work. That's not the way Sharia existed for the bulk of human history. It was not this top-down approach that we're seeing in Iran, for example, where the government forces the hijab on women in a way that's where they can whoop. There's never actually in our history, I'll tell you this much, I don't know of a single Islamic land back when they were the caliphate where hijab was enforced in a violent way. I don't know of a single Muslim land that did that. Like when you read the travels of Ibn Battuta, he complains, like he went to a Muslim country and the woman never used to cover their breasts. And he spent a few years working in that country as a mufti, trying to encourage the woman to dress modestly. And after a while, he gave up and he just moved on to the next land, right? there's no violence. There's no enforcing. It's just advising because, and again, the criminal laws in Islam are for very few things. Most things are just simply advice. You're not really going to enforce it, right? the things that will be enforced is no public intoxication, no fornication, adultery, you know, very few things, no murder, no stealing. Those are the things that are enforced with criminal laws. But the average practice of Islam, a lot of it was just through nasiha, through advice, through commanding the good and forbidding the evil. It wasn't a government-forced thing. Now, under this new system, you see crazy stuff happening. You have stuff like ISIS, right? Where I read that they would whoop people for smoking cigarettes or playing soccer. Like, that's not Sharia. That's not something that doesn't exist in the Sharia. This is just, again, this idea that the government can control everything. That's not how Sharia works. So there is no example in the world today of Sharia. What we have is a modern state system and people trying to put elements of Sharia into it, and it's just not working.
I'm really glad you made that clarification, and I'm not going to just pick on Brother Daniel Hakikachu, because Daniel Hakikachu has done a lot of good work for the community, for sure. One of the things he said is he thought that hijab should be compulsory, and I see a lot of people online now saying that hijab should be compulsory and that countries like Iran are right for having that as a law, and I'm glad you said something, because that struck me the wrong way. It just didn't seem like that was I'm not an educated person.
Hijab is compulsory. Hijab is compulsory.
It's compulsory.
But it's a it's a type of compulsion where there's no hard punishment for it. There's no criminal punishment
for it. Excuse me.
Maybe the government could advise. Maybe they could fine people. Maybe they could create an environment where it's encouraged. Maybe there's a simple way of them enforcing it if they have to, right? But I've never seen it historically. Historically, you will hear stories of women dressed inappropriately in almost every era in Muslim history. There wasn't, I don't know, I might be wrong. I don't know of any historical incidents where the government prescribed a punishment for women who were dressed indecently, right?
Right.
I don't know of that happening historically. But again, we would say it's an obligation in the sense that if you don't do it, you are committing a sin in the sight of God. It's an obligation in that sense, not something that the state can impose on you. So the difference between one's obligations to God and what the state can impose on you.
Yes, that's what I meant. Thank you for clarifying. Yes, that's what I'm going for. Here in Indonesia, you can see in Jakarta alone, you can see a whole gamut of people. This is something that I think Indonesia does better than other Muslim countries that I've been to, is that they allow a full gamut for how people are, because not everybody is as serious about the deen as other people. Some people are more on the deen, and basically you have people from niqabis all the way down to women in short shorts and tank tops here going on the same bus together, and nobody really bats an eye about it, as far as the government's concerned.
But now the ulama and the teachers and the parents, it's their job to advise and it's their job to encourage. And it's their job to tell people what's right and wrong. But to some extent, you can't really enforce it, right? And here's the other thing people don't realize, right? A lot of what modern Muslims perceive of as a caliphate or an Islamic state never existed in our history, right? Because, again, they are viewing it from the model of a modern state with Sharia laws. And they have these bizarre ideas like everyone's going to be pious, and everyone's going to be religious, and everyone's going to be good. This has never existed. In the time of the Sahaba, you would find there were people who had prostitutes. There were people who drank alcohol. There were people who dressed indecently. Every society is going to have its good people and its bad people, right? And everything in between. And the role of the Muslim government is to encourage good and to forbid evil and to facilitate spirituality. But one of the things that you will find in the Islamic state, in a proper Islamic land, is the valuing of privacy, that you don't get involved in people's private lives, right? So if someone is fornicating behind closed doors, it's the government won't get involved. Nobody will get involved. It's their private sin between them and God. And people would know these things are going. They would know that a certain house is a prostitute's house or a, you know, a gay person's house. And everybody would just ignore it because it's private, right? It's their private sin. As long as the sin is done in private, it's somebody's private business between them and God. Once it's done publicly, then yes, the government can say, hold on, this is now public indecency. This is now public immorality. Now we can force some kind of punishment or some kind of rule to prevent the spread of public immorality, right? So what the government would handle would be the spread of public immorality. But people's private sins would be their own business. The idea that if we had a caliphate today, and by the way, I'm completely pro-caliphate, right? I'm 100% pro-caliphate. I'm simply saying people's perception of it is incorrect. This yes. idea that if you had a caliphate today, that everybody would be pious and every woman would be in full niqab with their face covered and every man would have a big beard. I'm sorry, that has never existed in our history.
Never.
That has never existed, and that would not exist because that's just not how human beings are. You have to have some room for people who have weaker iman or people who are not as strong or people who are not as pious to just exist and at least be Muslim.
Would you say that Saudi Arabia, Wahhabism is an offshoot of, I'm being very careful how I say this. Because when I say the word Wahhabi or Salafi, it has so many connotations and it can go off in so many directions and people have different definitions. Would you say that the modern Wahhabi brand of Islam is the source of this confusion? Or does the source go back further than that? Because you talked earlier about the...
I would say it's one of the products of it.
It's one of the products of it, okay.
One of the products, not the source. Because they are as influenced by modernity as anybody else without realizing it, right?
Okay.
Their perception of what an Islamic state would look like, their perception of what is Orthodox Islam and what is the enemy's understanding of Islam, all of it is shaped by modernity. They are not the source. They are a product of the environment, a product of the modern world. And I mean, the origins are something else. The origins was more a tribe. It's similar to the Protestant movement, right? In that they wanted to reform Islam and they went a bit too far. But what we see in the past 60 years, especially what emerged in the, from the 1940s till now, what emerged during that period that became known as Salafism or Wahhabism, most of it, if you really look at it, it's a product of modernity, that they are influenced by the world around them, whether they realize it or not. Just to give you one example of that, their idea of not criticizing the ruler, right?
Yes.
Very different from the Sahaba's understanding. I mean,
yes.
Abdullah ibn Abbas criticized the ruler. Abdullah ibn Zubayr criticized the ruler, fought against the ruler, really, declared his own caliphate. Hussein radiallahu anhu criticized the ruler. The Sahaba did not see it as black and white as they do. But in their eyes, it's a black and white issue. Any criticism of the ruler is khuruj, right? That's their way of looking at it. Now, again, this black and white thinking, where does it come from? My theory, this idea that everything has a right answer and a wrong answer, everything, there's clearly only one way to do it. Where does this come from? It goes back to our original topic, the school system. Because in school, we are taught everything you do in your exams or in your tests is either right or it's wrong. Right? There's no room for differences of opinion. There's no spectrum of opinions. There's no idea of ikhtilaf. Right? Everything is just right or wrong. So people grow up with this right or wrong mindset. Everything's either right or wrong. You see it when people approach you about fiqh issues, right? They'll tell you, Sheikh, what is the correct opinion on the prohibition of music? And if you tell them, there's no correct opinion. There's a variety of opinions. Right? Exactly. There's a spectrum of opinions. They're like, no, there has to be one right opinion. This is not school. It's not school. There's no one right opinion. There's ijtihad. In ijtihad, there's going to be a spectrum of opinions. But people can't think like that anymore because school has killed the ability to think outside of black and white. So like when it comes to the issue of obeying the rulers, yes, there is a concept of obeying the rulers in Islam, but it's not black and white. There's a spectrum of opinions on to what extent do you obey the rulers, what extent are you allowed to criticize them, when and how. You will find a variety of opinions, right? So we're not saying the position itself is wrong, but the modern application of it is a product of modernity. Right, the way people perceive of it and apply it today is a product of modernity, and it's not of how the predecessors who stated those same opinions. They wouldn't have applied it or thought of it the way people are doing that today.
Yes, I think that makes a lot of sense. What I noticed in Salafism, the positive about Salafism is that it is a sincere desire to return to go to, back to what is the real faith. The problem is that, okay, well, what is the real original faith? And then the other thing I see about Salafism, and this is a little bit theoretical here, and keep in mind I'm not a scholar when I say this, there are people who have suggested that perhaps the original source of Salafi thinking goes back to at least Ibn Taymiyyah. The idea that, hey, we've got problems in our ummah today, we've got to remove all the shirk and the bid'ah, all the innovation and all the confusion, and go back to the pure form of Islam. You could say it really goes back to Ibn Taymiyyah. But then the problem with that is, when I look at Ibn Taymiyyah's writings and his life, the guy was actually pretty nuanced, and he changed his opinion on things at different points in his life. One of the things I noticed about Ibn Taymiyyah, I found this out from watching Blogging Theology with Paul Williams, which is a great channel. Ibn Taymiyyah, and I think Dr. Shabir Ali also mentioned this, Ibn Taymiyyah towards the end of his life took the minority position of scholars, a minority position, and he believed that hellfire was not eternal for most people. And that's a minority opinion. And I'm so like, I, when people in the Salafi movement keep talking about, oh, we love Ibn Taymiyyah, Ibn Taymiyyah is our guy, you know, that kind of thing, I go, okay, but then did you actually understand Ibn Taymiyyah? Because to me, when I look at Ibn Taymiyyah, he was actually far more nuanced than he's made out to be. And my, I guess my question is, why is that not reaching through? Is it because they're learning from scholars who are in a state institution? Or is it because they're just kind of in a reactionary mindset? Why is that understanding of Ibn Taymiyyah not following through?
There's many answers to that. For one, they only study specific opinions of Ibn Taymiyyah, not all of his writings, right? But again, going back to our original topic about the education system, Ibn Taymiyyah lived in a very different world from us. He lived in a time where it was okay to have your own opinions. Right, he lived in a time where the ijtihad was a thing. Right, he lived in a time where we didn't have this black and white thinking of modernity. And what's happening is people are now taking his opinions and looking at it from a modern lens. So you have people today who would see a statement by Ibn Taymiyyah and treat it as if it's equal to the Quran or the Hadith, right? While he himself would not have looked at his own statements in that way. He would have looked at them as his ijtihad with the potential of being wrong. And so people have, you know, I mean, I myself am a huge fan of Ibn Taymiyyah. I have most of his books. I've studied most of his books. I share his opinions on many issues, especially in the area of Aqidah. But as someone who studied with Salafis at one point in my life, the biggest disconnect I had is that their idea of who Ibn Taymiyyah was and what I was actually reading in his books were completely different. And that's what put me off the movement. Mm-hmm. And I brought it up with my teachers, and they themselves had some cognitive dissonance there. They were like, no, you know, maybe you misreading him. He can't have said that. He can't have believed that. He's Ibn Taymiyyah. There's no way he held that opinion. But it's there. It's in his books. He was not as black and white thinking as they are. He was a very nuanced person who made ijtihad, who changed his opinions, he was very humble. He accepted the idea that he could be wrong. And right till the end, he was always rethinking through whatever ideas he held, which is the Islamic approach to knowledge, right?
Yeah.
It's not the clear-cut black and white that modern-day movements want it to be. It is, as I said before, it's a spectrum of knowledge, and people have lost the idea of being able to think on a spectrum of knowledge. Instead, they want everything to be right and wrong, which in of itself is a problematic way of looking at the world, and especially a problematic way of looking at the religion.
Well, I appreciate that. That was a great clarification because, a lot of people that I deal with in the comment section, the most negative responses I get are not from, it's sometimes from the Sufis, but it's usually the Salafis that give me the harshest responses. And then I talk to people like you or I see a lot of people like Dr. Yasser Qadi, who used to describe himself as Salafi as well. And he has had his own personal journey away from Salafism. Now, I don't want to hate on Salafism because there's a lot of good things that have come out of that movement. But as you point out, there is a...
No, I don't like to talk bad about the movement because, again, my teachers were Salafis. And I've met a lot of pious Salafis in my life who I highly respect. and I have seen the benefits of it, and it's helped me in my life in many ways. So I don't talk bad about it, but I do see it as a product of modernity, just like any other Muslim movement that popped up in the past 100 years. And so that's why I'm not patriotic to it, just as I'm not patriotic to any other modern Muslim movement. I'm able to see it for what it is. It's a revivalist effort in the modern world that has its pros and cons, just like every other revivalist effort.
And some of these criticisms could also be given of Sufism as well. Am I correct in saying that?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's correct.
Because, in Ibn Taymiyyah's time, they were also very institutionalized and very black and white in their thinking as well, weren't they? That's why I got in trouble with them. Okay.
That's true. Yeah.
Okay. So any of our Salafi listeners who are deeply offended and write down subscribe for me, just let you know. We got criticisms for other people too. I get a lot of criticisms from Salafis like all the time. So just bear with me. Well, Sheikh, I appreciate you coming out. We got on a lot of sidetracks here, which is a good thing and a bad thing, but it's important. Circling back around to solutions, because we talked about education, how it's become a mess. What is this modern version of this confusion? Was the modern system versus was the classical system? We got into how it ties into other aspects of life, commerce, politics, etc. We got a little bit off the weeds there, but what's the solution that you think is going to really fix this problem? It's obviously we can't go back to where we were 100%. Mm-hmm. We're in the age of the internet now, in the age of online education, so forth and so on. What do you think the future looks like or should look like?
Okay, so I'm going to divide this into two parts, the immediate solutions and the long-term solutions. Immediate solutions is for parents who are able to start homeschooling, right? And okay, if you just say you're a young person watching this and your parents can't homeschool you, then your immediate solution as a young person is to take control of your own journey of knowledge outside of school, right? Mm-hmm. So you go to school, but in the afternoons and evenings, you watch other things online, you read other books online, you begin to initiate your own studies, right? To help you uncover what the schools are not teaching you, to help you bridge the gaps on subjects that schools are not teaching. So retaking control of your own journey of knowledge, which is how humans have been for the bulk of human history. Now, as for long-term solutions, I haven't settled on one yet, but I have a few ideas, right? The first idea is that we replace compulsory education with a culture of learning. Right, we replace compulsory education with a culture of learning. And what a culture of learning would mean is that children are raised with a love of learning and access to resources so that they can learn whatever they need to learn when they need to learn it. And today, with the internet, with YouTube, with online courses, with books, there's no end to resources. Anyone can teach themselves anything at any age. That's the world we live in today, which already makes school obsolete. It already makes school obsolete, right? My kids, my teenagers, what they learn on their own online vastly outweighs what they've learned from school, on the school curriculum, vastly outweighs it. And
that was my kids too.
I've seen this also, like one of my kids taught himself how to read when he was 5 years old, without going to school, without his parents helping him at all. He wanted to read, he taught himself how to read. And I realized that anyone can actually do that. Like historically, if people wanted to read, they would teach themselves how to do so within a few months. It's very easy to learn when you're motivated. And that's a big problem with the school system today. Because we have forced education, people see learning as a burden. People see learning as something that's not fun. People see learning as something that they hate. People see reading as something that's a chore. School has created all of these perceptions. Pull them away from school and put them into a natural learning environment. They will love to read. They would love to learn new things. They would love to grow their mind. They would love to develop new skills. So my main idea is to replace the school system with a culture of learning. I believe if a country has a culture of learning, it does not need a compulsory school system. Everybody would learn what they need to thrive in their lives. And it goes back to a principle that I forgot to mention today, and that is a principle I apply to both parenting and education. Every child is unique. There's no one system that's going to work for everybody. And that's one of the biggest problems with the school system today. We are taking a standardized approach to education and mass producing it across the globe, while in reality, every child is unique in terms of their strengths, their weaknesses, their goals, their vision, what subjects they're attracted to, what they want to do with their lives, how they learn, what system of learning works best for them, what system of learning they are weak at. Every child is unique. And if you're just going to have this mass-produced system, a lot of people are going to go to the system thinking that they are stupid or thinking that they are dumb, but in reality, they're just not given the right resources or styles of learning, right?
Right.
They simply put in a system that doesn't work for them. So I would love to see a world where instead of forced education, we have a culture of learning. And if you have a culture of learning with unlimited access to resources, right, where everyone has access to the resources that they need to learn, then I really don't think the world would need school anymore unless you are someone who's going down a very specific career path. Like if you are becoming a doctor or a lawyer or an accountant, then yes, there needs to be a systematic study to get there. But for the average person who just wants to run a business or be a plumber or you know, be a freelance writer or something like that, they really don't need the school system at all. It's absolutely not beneficial to their lives at all.
No, that's very true, Sheikh. I appreciate you clarifying that. I was just thinking as you were saying this, you know, some of the things that I've been saying in dialoguing with people back in the States, because after I dropped out of university, I tried my hand at trade schools for a while as a truck driver and then a commercial diver briefly, and tried my hand at a couple other things. And for a while, I was of the opinion, yeah, screw school. Everybody should just go to trade school. And then the more I think about it, trade school is the same problem. It can be the same sort of institutionalized problem rather than just going with an apprenticeship, which is how you used to learn trade. Or just, you, like you said, there's so many ways you can learn how to do a lot of these trade professions on your own.
I'm very passionate about reviving mentorship and apprenticeship. I believe that these things work very well in past communities and societies. If we could revive those systems today, they would not just help people learn better, but they will create meaningful relationships, right? Because the mentee relationship is a very powerful relationship that's dying out in our times. But historically, a lot of great figures were built from those type of relationships. So I'm very passionate about reviving those systems of learning as well.
That's a good point. Yes, it's very personal. You just go, bzz, go to the next class, bzz, next class. Next year, you have a different set of teachers. And then you, after 3-4 years of that school, you go to the next school, and it's a different thing. Different. It's basically the same thing, more advanced level of learning, but it's, you're just getting passed from person to person to person.
Yeah.
Most teachers, you don't really remember. I don't remember half the teachers.
On the other hand, if you look, for example, like Imam Abu Hanifa, he spent 17 years studying fiqh with one teacher. Can you imagine the relationship they had spending 17 years as a student and teacher relationship, right?
Wow.
We don't get that in our times anymore.
Wow. No, I don't think I've ever known any teacher for that long or had a relationship with them like that. 17 years? No.
Yeah.
No, I can't think of one. No. Oddly enough, I would say if you go to the same jujitsu, people who do martial arts in the same town for an extended period of time probably have the closest thing to that, because
yeah. And then also that's because martial arts is not passed through the forced education system, but they're still using the same systems of teaching and learning from before that, right? So it still has that mentor mentees type of system. It still has that long term relationship with the shifu. I've seen that even in my children's lives, that they still have a close relationship with their shifu, even though they studied with him like 5 or 6 years ago. But it's a relationship that you build with your teacher, because they're still using the traditional systems of learning when it comes to martial arts.
Yes, I'm going to use that as an example from now on when I'm trying to describe this to people, what right looks like. Hopefully they don't confuse it with some martial arts studio that just popped up last week, but yes, traditional martial arts for sure.
Yes.
Jake, I really appreciate that. Is there anything else you want to add before we wrap it up here? We're a little bit past the hour. I know you had some places you had to go to.
Oh, yes. In an hour's time, I have a homeschooling class to teach, but yeah, I just want to on a point that some people, when they hear all of this, they misunderstand, especially if they are a product of the system, and especially if they thrived in the system, right? Some people, the system is built for them. They get all A's, they graduate, they're top of the class, they're the most favorite student in school, they do well in university. So they wonder why anyone would ever be against the system. I want people to be clear about one point. I'm not against education. I'm not against people learning. I'm not against people seeking knowledge. I am 100% for that. I'm simply saying there's a better way. There are many better ways than what we have and what's been forced on people in the modern world. And I want us to start thinking outside of this box. This box has really affected people's ability to think for themselves. That people who have gone through the system, many of them cannot think outside of the system on any issues. They just see the world as it is, not as it can be. And it makes it very difficult for them to grasp these kind of ideas. So let us learn to think outside of the box. Let us learn to understand that any man-made system could be replaced with another man-made system, maybe a much better one. So if people 200 years ago came up with this system, and in our times we are seeing that this system doesn't work, it had very negative roots, and it's gotten even worse over time. So like today, the system is a way of brainwashing people into being pro-LGBTQ, right? It's getting worse over time. Because again, it was created to create people who just blindly follow the government. And that's what the government wants people to believe now, right? So that's forcing that on them in the school system. So let us start thinking outside. Let us realize that humans have always been capable of learning. They've always been capable of teaching. They've always been capable of living up to their potential. School isn't necessary for that. It may be necessary for specific career paths, but it's not necessary for everybody. And if we can come up with better ideas, better systems, then we could create a better future for the next generation. So I hope more people will get on board with this, start thinking like this, maybe start sharing ideas, and perhaps within the next 5 or 10 years, we'll have something concrete that we can launch as a alternative to school. That's my hope. To one day launch an alternative to school and to slowly start rolling it out globally. Allah knows best.
Allah knows best indeed. Thank you so much for your time, Sheikh. All right, Sheikh, where can people find you?
So just type in my name on Twitter or YouTube or Instagram. I'm there, alhamdulillah. I do most of my yapping on Twitter. I like to just share my scattered thoughts on Twitter every day. So most likely be able to connect with me to Twitter or YouTube with the exact same name. Alhamdulillah.
All right. Alhamdulillah. Thank you. And we'll put some links to those in the video when we post it. Thank you so much, Jazakallah Khair, Sheikh. Thank you for coming on. Hope to see you on again.
All right. Jazakallah Khair. Assalamu alaikum.
Oh.